Dave Emery here, side two, for the record, program number 782. All's Well, that's Orwell, part two, The Ministry of Truth and the Ukrainian Crisis, part two, subtitled Shmeiman Uber Alles, being recorded on March 16th of the year 2014. Inside one, I raised a number of questions. I talked about the subtle and yet very purposefully distorted coverage that the New York Times has of the Ukrainian situation, characteristic, by the way, of the rest of our news media. And one of the points that we were taking up, first of all, a key member of the New York Times editorial board is a guy named Serge Shmeiman. I had not seen any bylines by him in some time. However, he has had some op-ed pieces in the Sunday Times, sort of interpreting events in the Ukraine for us. I remember his name from a frankly unfair review that he wrote of Christopher Simpson's Blowback back in 1988. Shmeiman was the former Bonn, Germany correspondent for the New York Times, and Shmeiman dismissed a very important and accurate point of Christopher Simpson that the importation of these Eastern European Nazi emigres under the Galen Org, the ABN, the Crusade for Freedom, had a very distorting effect on U.S. Cold War policy. And we took a look at the White Russian and French located heritage of Serge Shmeiman, and I'm asking, is it possible that Serge Shmeiman's grandfather may have been associated with a network called the Promethean League? And is it possible that they also, the elder Alexander Shmeiman may have had some contact with intelligence of one kind or another, either Third Reich and or post-war Western intelligence, and what effect that may have had on Serge Shmeiman's journalistic coverage. We're going to be hearing about a network called the Promethean League. That was sort of like a pre-World Anti-Communist League, sort of a pre-Wackle. It was based in Poland. It was heavily subsidized by Marshal Sikorsky in Poland. It also, however, had a very strong French component. It was subsidized by French intelligence, and a lot of its activists and writers were in France during the period between the wars. Significant elements of the Promethean League ultimately went on to join with the Third Reich, and then after the war with various elements of Western intelligence, including pan-Turkists and also some of the Ukrainians of the OUNB stripe. So we're going to be taking a look at Earth Island politics and the Ukrainian crisis next week. We are going to be asking the question, is some of the Times' distorted coverage of this, is it just due to its sort of de rigueur CIA spin, or does some of the Shmeiman heritage, possible links with the Promethean League come to bear on this as well? We're going to be listening to some excerpts from AFA program number 14, the first of two programs about the World Anti-Communist League. This was recorded in January of 1986. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck, whose assistance with the on-air responsibilities was invaluable.
Following information about the Prometheus Network, this pre-Wackle based in Pilsudski's Poland, which involved pan-Turkist elements to a considerable extent, information on this comes from a book called Pan-Turkism in Turkey, subtitled A Study of Irredentism, was authored by Jacob Landau, L-A-N-D-A-U, published in London by C. Hurst & Company. I don't know the date offhand. Landau writes of the Prometheus Network as follows. Speaking of the period just before World War II, during this period, several periodicals of pan-Turk character were published in Europe. Most were issued regularly, probably because of the expenses involved, but there were two exceptions. Turan Mekumasi, published in Budapest, and Prometheus, an anti-Soviet journal originating in Poland. And of Prometheus, skipping down, Landau writes, and talking here about something which we needn't concern ourselves with, which is pan-Turanic journals here and so forth. It was evident that it's not important to pay attention to that, but leading into discussion of the Prometheus Network, It was evident that the Turan Society and its publications constituted an expression of the isolation felt by the Hungarians in what appeared to them as a hostile environment, as well as a manifestation of their search for potential allies. To a great extent, this was also the feeling of those Polish circles which published the other long-term interwar periodical, Prometheus. This was the organ of the Promethean League, a semi-clandestine, anti-Soviet association established and sponsored by President Pilsudski, the Polish Ministry for Foreign Affairs, and the General Staff as an umbrella organization to provide financial assistance and political coordination for anti-communist governments in exile. All those who had suffered at the hands of the Soviets were considered as their natural allies against the Soviet peril. Among these, the outside Turks held a prominent position. The association's bulletin, Prométhée, Organe de défense des nationales des peuples du Caucase et de l'Ukraine, was published monthly in Paris from November of 1926 to April of 1938. Note here that in addition to the outside Turks, Ukrainian nationalists were very prominent in Prometheus. Continuing, Turkestan was subsequently added to its masthead, and the publication was ultimately named Prométhée, Organe de défense des nationales des peuples of the USSR. Well-known pan-Turkists such as Wezul Zad, Mirza Bala, and others contributed articles about the strong sentiments for independence and for a pan-Turk union in Azerbaijan, the Caucasus, and Turkestan. Polish financial aid to pan-Turkist organizations may well have continued even during the Second World War. This subject, however, lies beyond the scope of our immediate concern. What does not lie outside of the scope of our immediate concern, though, is that the anti-Soviet aspirations of the pan-Turkists and other elements, the Ukrainians of the Promethean League, were to find expression in the Third Reich.
Now, this next section is from a book called Turkism and the Soviets, and the book is by Charles Warren Hostler, Colonel, U.S. Air Force, and it's published 1957 by George Allen and Unwin Limited of London.
It's also worth noting that some of the people who helped, this guy was an Air Force colonel who did a lot of research on this stuff, and there's an interesting note there.
And as we get into this, the segment we're reading itself, you'll notice a kind of a slightly interesting tone to some of the comments the man makes about these Turkish connections to the Third Reich. And one of the things, you may remember a name from the first article that we read, he talks about Hostler in his foreword, mentions, how does he put it? Okay, here, returning from Turkey in 1950, I was assigned to the U.S. Air Force's far-sighted graduate training program at Georgetown University. Okay. In this period, I had the good fortune to become associated with Dr. Stefan T. Passani, who guided me in writing a shorter study, The Pan-Turanian Appeal, et cetera, et cetera. And he thanks Passani again at the end. Now, Passani, again, is a figure of the far right affiliated with WACL, as we mentioned in the first article.
And a member of the WACCFL steering committee that we just looked at with Messrs. Kramer and Guyland.
And a bigwig at our own local Hoover Institution, as well as his affiliation with Georgetown. Georgetown, of course, we've talked about a great deal because of its involvement in a whole variety of right-wing politics, and it's basically, among other things, it's a journalist factory for the right wing. And we talked about Claire Sterling, Michael Ledeen, Arno de Borgrav, et cetera, et cetera. Claire Sterling, Michael Ledeen, again, particularly interesting because of the fact that, as Dave mentioned, the pan-Turkist movement comes in very strongly into the assassination attempt on the Pope. And here we have this other connection to Georgetown, to Passani, and things like that. Of people writing about these same groups also, and also being affiliated with the World Anti-Communist League. So that's something we'll probably get into at a later point. Anyway, I'm going to read a little bit from Turkism and the Soviets by Charles Warren Hostler, USAF and Georgetown graduate. The pan-Turkist irredentists regarded as inevitable the defeat of the USSR and considered possible the creation of a confederation of all the Turkish peoples of Soviet Russia and Chinese Turkestan under the Turkish Republic's leadership. In general, Soviet sources are in accord with the Western ones on this question, and Miller, in his Ocherki Noveshi Histori Turci, begins the story of German-Turkish collaboration with a period preceding the outbreak of the German-Soviet War. Four days prior to the German attack on the Soviets on July 18, 1941, the Turkish-German Pact of Friendship and Non-Aggression was signed. In the interval from 1941 to 1942, the Turkish press openly assailed the Soviets. There were indications of increased Turkish preparation to take part in events and to arrange Caucasian and other Turkish areas independently or with German concurrence. In the autumn of 1942, the Turks concentrated troops at the Caucasian border, anticipating the fall of Stalingrad. The anti-Soviet campaign of the Turkish press had then reached its zenith. One may conclude that highly placed persons in the Turkish state had plans ready to exploit all the possibilities the German-Soviet war and a collapse of the USSR could furnish for the realization of pan-Turkish ideals. The outbreak of the war in June 1941 aroused great hopes among the Turco-Tatar leaders scattered in the West and in Turkey. Nearly all of these leaders approached the Germans and supplied them with various aid memoirs, documents, etc. The Germans also sought contacts and the exchange of opinions. Veli Kajum Khan, one of the chief followers of Mustafa Chokai, also Kokaylo or Chokayev, a leader of the Turkestanis, we'll just call him Mustafa Chokai, a leader of the Turkestanis, was in touch with the Germans and had given them pertinent facts on Turkestan. He insisted that Turkestan should not become part of any future Russian Federation. Mehmet Emin Rezulzadeh, the head of the Azerbaijan Musavat Party, went to Bucharest after the occupation of Poland in 1939. He sent an exhaustive report to the Germans and subsequently went to Berlin. The Promethean leaders, who were living in Warsaw during the German occupation, also supplied the Germans with material.
Noting there a continuation of anti-Soviet policy from the Promethean organization originally under Polish sponsorship, a continuity of action to the Third Reich.
Ayas Ishaki and Syed Shamil, leaders of the Kazan Tatars and North Caucasians respectively, also went to Berlin. The Crimean Turks were represented in Berlin by Mustagib Fazil and Edige Kirimal, mentioned above in the letter from General, well, we don't care about that, and several Turkish politicians and unofficial representatives, including ex-General Erkilet, traveled there or... several Turkish politicians and unofficial representatives, including ex-General Erkilet, traveled there or visited the front lines. Edige Kirimal and other Turco-Tatar leaders were permitted by the Germans to visit the occupied portions of the Turco-Tatar regions of the Soviet Union, namely Crimea and the Northern Caucasus. A most important political and military aspect of World War II pan-Turkist activity involved the national military units formed of Turks from the Soviet Union, who fought in the German armed forces against the Soviets. The idea of forming these units originated with two prominent Turks, Mustafa Chokai and Veli Kajum Khan. Mustafa Chokai died in December 1941, but German-educated Kajum Khan became commissioner for Turkestan, together with the other commissioners for Azerbaijan, Volga, Ural, Caucasus, and Crimea, who were appointed by the German Ostministerium, Ministry for Occupied Eastern Territories. The idea of using the Turks of the USSR in the fight against the Soviets must have been readily accepted by the German High Command, whose approach to such problems were purely utilitarian. There was probably no serious Nazi political opposition to this idea, as the territories inhabited by the Turks of the USSR lay in general outside the limits of planned direct expansion of the Reich.
I would interrupt that this is wishful thinking on his part. In fact, one of the key people that we're going to look at, Theodor Oberland, now this is sort of an aside, who was actually imprisoned in a concentration camp for a short time for proposing the use of these various Turkic nationalities as allies of the Third Reich. After a while, the German losses forced a reconsideration of that position. But initially, they were pure Aryans, and so they were actually scornful. Although they would use them, they would not grant them equal ally status. And so that's actually sort of not an accurate statement on his part here.
The Germans needed military security and combat replacements. The receptiveness of the Turkish prisoners of war to the proposal stemmed in part from their political and religious convictions. The Wehrmacht was aware of their propaganda influence on other Soviet troops of Turk background and also of their political potential of diminishing enemy resistance, achieving speedy pacification of occupied territory, and making allies out of these populations. The overwhelming majority of the Turk volunteers were recruited from among Soviet prisoners of war captured by the Germans. The 162nd Infantry Division, commanded by General Oskar von Niedermayer, a well-known German specialist in Middle Eastern affairs, was assigned the task of organizing them into combat battalions. This activity was implemented by Army Group South, which was largely in the central Ukraine area. a top-secret memoir by Rosenberg, that's Albert Rosenberg, concerning his discussion with Hitler on December 14, 1941, indicates by that date, partial Turkization of these units was completed, and the experience was judged successful. On December 30, 1941, the high command of the Wehrmacht was directed to establish a Turkestan Legion, consisting of members of the following nationalities: Turkmens, Uzbeks, Kazakhs, Kyrgyzs, Karakalpaks, and Tajiks. B, Caucasian Mohammedan Legion, composed of Azerbaijanis, Dagestanis, Ingushes, Lezhins, and Chechens. C, a Georgian Legion. And D, an Armenian Legion.
By the way, Armenia is one of these territories which has sort of got bisected during the imperial period. Half of it's in Russia, half of it's in Turkey. Like Azerbaijan, another area in the Soviet Union, is half in Soviet and half in Iran.
A Volga Tatar Legion and a North Caucasian Legion were formed in 1942. These legions were training centers where national units were organized and indoctrinated. For each of them, a corresponding national committee existed. The commanding officers of these legions had the disciplinary authority of a commander of an independent battalion. They were subordinate to the commander of the 162nd Infantry Division. The legions received prisoners of war from collecting camps and were charged with training them into future combat battalions. Each legion headquarters had a permanent cadre of German military personnel and the necessary number of Turks selected by the legion commander. After completing of their training and political indoctrination, the combat battalions left the 167th Infantry Division for attachment to different active German divisions. During the subsequent war years, the Turks, the Germans grouped the Georgians, Armenians, etc. under this term as well, furnished the rank and file elements of 19 unattached battalions and 24 companies. Among other duties, these units were used for frontline action and for fighting partisans. As early as May 1942, Turk Battalion No. 450 fought valiantly against partisans near Jampol in the Ukraine and dispersed the enemy after suffering 28 casualties. There were only two German officers and two non-commissioned officers attached to this battalion. The post of General der Osttruppen was established in December 1942. It was occupied first by General Helmich and then by General Kestring. As a result of the activities of the Turkestan National Committee, the East Turkish Waffenverband, a Waffen-SS unit, was formed in 1944 of four regiments of two battalions each, one composed of Turks from Turkestan, another of Azerbaijanis, a third one of Volga-Ural Turks, and the fourth of Crimean Tatars. Now, one thing to notice here, just for future reference, because we're not going to need to deal with it too much tonight, but notice the fact, again, as so often happened to these groups, of these groups with whatever their particular gripe was to begin with, getting involved in coming into the Nazi sphere of influence, and then not only having that initial movement in that direction, but then going through official training and indoctrination. And believe me, folks, it seems to stick, and we're going to be talking about that in future broadcasts.
Okay, and again, note the continuity of policy from the various anti-Soviet groups who combined under the Promethean banner in Pilsudski's Poland. Then Prometheus gives assistance during the German occupation to the Nazis. The Pan-Turkists seize upon the Nazis as they're basically their vehicle for the partitioning of the Soviet Union and the adding of the Turkic speaking peoples to a greater Turkey. And note in particular the use of various Turkic minorities in German military units to fight against the USSR. Now again, the anti-Bolshevik nations or the peoples involved with the anti-Bolshevik nations became one of the key elements of the Galen spy organization both during World War II and afterward when it jumped to the U.S. Now recall the various Turkic minorities working for the Germans in their military units. Reading a short section now from a book called Galen, Spy of the Century, published in hardcover by Random House, copyright 1971, and authored by a man named E.H. Cookridge. Galen, by the way, was the head of Foreign Armies East. He was Hitler's chief intelligence officer for the Eastern Front, in charge of all intelligence activities in that theater. After the war, he jumped to the United States and then NATO and finally to West Germany with not only his whole organization but with his files intact. So a continuity of intelligence functions from the Third Reich to the United States to NATO to modern Germany, and again, all under this man, Reinhard Galen. Now, of some of the activities of Reinhard Galen's Foreign Armies East, and specifically the use of Turkic peoples in military units on the Eastern Front, We're going to encounter a name here who's a key person with regard to the World Anti-Communist League, and we're going to be coming back to him. Reading from Galen's Spy of the Century. From such Caucasian defectors was recruited a battalion, codenamed Bergman, or Miner, which grew to comprise three Georgian, one Azerbaijani, and one Armenian company under the command of Captain Theodor Oberlander. Some of these men went into action in October of 1942 at Terek and Mozduk, collecting 1,600 defectors from a Soviet division whose political commissar was Mikhail Suslov. So again, Theodor Oberlander, a key member of WACL, as we're going to look at shortly, was commanding a battalion composed of Turkic defectors fighting now against the USSR.
Okay, this is from a Village Voice article, May 14, 1985, headline Reagan and the War Crimes Lobby. The article is by Joe Connison. He also wrote the first article, along with Murray Wass, that we read tonight on the broadcast. A leading figure among the rightist emigres is, they're talking again about the rightist emigres who are specifically, in this case, trying to smash the Office of Special Investigations, which is investigating World War II war criminals in the United States, many of whom are Eastern European emigres, many of whom are strongly affiliated with the Reagan administration, as we've been talking about tonight, among their supporters, not only Ronald Reagan, but his communications director, Pat Buchanan. A leading figure among the rightist emigres is Dr. Lev Dobryansky, Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas and chairman of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, the UCCA, and the Captive Nations Committee, Incorporated. Dobryansky, whose daughter Paula serves on the staff of the National Security Council, is also board chairman of a leading emigre publication, the Ukrainian Quarterly. Another is Yaroslav Stetsko, chairman of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, the ABN. We've been talking about them a lot tonight. And for a brief period in the summer of 1941, premier of the Independent Republic of the Ukraine. Stetsko, an elder statesman of the international far right, was received at the White House in July 1983 by the President and Vice President George Bush. He and Dobryansky also helped to create the World Anti-Communist League, the organizational haven for neo-Nazis, fascists, and anti-Semitic extremists from two dozen countries, formerly headed by racial theorist Roger Pearson. The spotty history of wartime Ukrainian nationalism is useful in understanding the anti-OSI campaign. OSI, of course, Office of Special Investigations, the people who are trying to deport these war criminals. It's useful in understanding the anti-OSI campaign in which Dobryansky, Stetsko, and their compatriots are implicated. For centuries, the believers in a separate Ukrainian state were frustrated by rulers from without, Polish, German, and Russian, and irritated by the presence on their soil of non-Ukrainians, principally Poles and Jews. These sentiments found expression in a variety of nationalist organizations, but the most important role during the war was played by the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, OUN, a fascistic outfit that freely employed terror and murder in its quest for a racially pure Ukrainian state. By 1940, after Hitler and Stalin divided the Ukraine between them, the OUN had split into two factions. The more active and radical, the OUNB, was identified by the last name of its would-be Führer, Stepan Bandera. His most trusted lieutenant was a young nationalist named Yaroslav Stetsko. Hitler's plan to invade the Soviet Union involved a campaign through the Ukraine, with the promised assistance of the OUN Bandera, whose chief patron in the Nazi regime was the real Führer's racial mentor, Alfred Rosenberg. But there was disagreement among the top Nazi leaders on the, quote, Ukrainian question. Heinrich Himmler and Martin Bormann, for example, insisted that Slavs were Untermenschen, lesser peoples whose only purpose on earth was to serve Aryan masters. To them, no Ukrainian state was tolerable. Rosenberg, himself a Baltic German, was more accommodating, and furthermore saw himself as the satrap of an eastern realm in a, quote, new Europe. OUN Bandera held its first and second congresses under Nazi auspices, and among its resolutions in 1941 was the following, quote, the Jews in the Soviet Union are the most dependable underpinning of the ruling Bolshevist regime, and an avant-garde of Muscovite imperialism in the Ukraine. The Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists opposes the Jews as a pillar of the Muscovite Bolshevist regime, and at the same time is informing the mass of people that Moscow is the main enemy. Such was the ideological preparation for the Nazi invasion and the Holocaust that came in its wake. Simultaneously, the OUN Bandera was adopted by the Nazi spy apparatus, the Abwehr, to aid in the actual invasion both militarily and for intelligence purposes. Battalions of OUN Bandera volunteers under German command were formed both in occupied Poland, the Nachtigall or Nightingale Division, and in Austria, the Roland Division. Though the surviving adherents of the OUN Bandera deny it, historical evidence shows that the Ukrainian nationalists under Bandera reached for an agreement with the Nazis for the future control of the Ukraine. On June 30, 1941, the Nazi invasion reached Lvov, the capital of the Ukrainian province of Galicia, which was the OUN Bandera stronghold. That same evening, the OUN Bandera leaders who had traveled to Galicia with the Nazis declared a sovereign Ukrainian state, with Yaroslav Stetsko as, quote, premier. The division among the Nazis erupted in reaction to this declaration, and within 10 days, Stetsko was placed under honorary arrest by officers of the SS. Although this arrest is now portrayed as severe repression by the OUN Bandera, in fact, the Germans treated Bandera and his followers rather well, especially compared to the Jews and other victims of the final solution in Lvov, which was being carried out by Nazi Einsatzgruppen and Ukrainian, quote, militia, including many OUN Bandera men. Indeed, according to Alexander Dalin's authoritative German Rule in Russia, 1941-45, quote, during the following days of chaos, after the entry into Lvov, it became obvious to the Germans that Bandera's followers, including those in the Nachtigall Regiment, were displaying considerable initiative, conducting purges and pogroms.
Okay, now, remember the Nachtigall Regiment, and in particular, note the use of the OUN Bandera and its formation in the SS, along with other elements of the ethnic nationalities that had aspired to carve up the Soviet Union, including, as we looked at, the Pan-Turkists. Now, recall that in Radio Free America numbers 1 and 2, we took a look at the OUN Bandera, the warfare that they carried on in Eastern Europe under SS auspices. We looked at them at considerable length at the tail end of Radio Free America number 1, and again, looked at the OUN Bandera's role in the SS and how later they jumped to the CIA along with the Galen organization. Now, the head of the Einsatzgruppen Nachtigall, the Einsatzgruppen were the mobile killing units that followed right behind the regular Wehrmacht units in Germany. They simply dispatched the Jews, communists, and other people that the Nazis wanted to get rid of. Now, the Nachtigall Regiment composed largely of Ukrainian nationalists and fascists from the OUN Bandera. We'll tell you who was the head of the Einsatzgruppen Nachtigall, referring to Theodor Oberlander and his wartime activities. At that time, Dr. Oberlander was an SS officer and a member of the notorious Abwehr. According to Die Zeit of Hamburg, he was an expert, quote, for the treatment of other races, unquote, and the political officer of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall. Okay, so Oberlander is commander of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall involving fascist Ukrainians. Oberlander's unit entered Lemberg on June 30th and remained in the city 6 days. According to Reitlinger and other sources, 7,000 people were killed, chiefly between July 2nd and 4th.
That again from AFA program number 14 from January of 1986. So note Theodor Oberlander, his stewardship of the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall, celebrated in the new Ukraine, and also the fact that he mobilized both Pan-Turkists and Turkic-speaking minorities in the former Soviet Union and Ukrainians on behalf of the Third Reich. Some of those same elements appear in the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, and we will be examining the possibilities that they may also be engaged in political warfare in the current situation. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 782, All's Well That's Orwell, The Ministry of Truth and the Ukrainian Crisis, Part 2, subtitled Schmemann über alles. This has been recorded on March 16th of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.